At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to a brand new episode of Silver Screen Podcast, where we're not even supposed to be here today, but we are, and we're diving into a film that redefined indie cinema. I am your usual host, Michael Wilson, along with my regular co-host, DK. Hello there.
Hello.
How are you doing? You okay?
I'm not too bad. I just woke up. I just fell out of the closet.
I've been here for like the last couple of hours. You've just strolled in to open the video store with two mad customers there waiting for you. So we are very much playing our parts for today. So fair enough. And we are joined once again, after just 7 days since his last appearance, by pop culture aficionado Michael Whaley. Welcome back, buddy.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. So you were just on talking about Scott Pilgrim because you're a huge Edgar Wright fan. So now we're talking about Clerks. I presume you must be a big Kevin Smith fan, yes.
Kevin Smith is number one on my top director list. So
nice, nice.
I think Edgar Wright's two or three. So like it was close. We've done two in a row with some of my favorites.
Great directors, so. Yeah, and in case you hadn't guessed, as I've already said, we are here to celebrate Kevin Smith's debut film, Clerks, for its 30th anniversary. Can you believe it's just a few weeks away from being exactly 30 years old, Clerks? God, we feel old now.
Makes me feel old.
Exactly, yeah. But here we are. We have to talk about it. From the snarky wit to the gritty black and white charm. Yes, we're talking all things Randall, Dante, and the trials of working a dead-end job, something that I know very well, and I'm sure we probably all do to some degree. So grab your favorite snack from the quick stop, and let's punch in for a nostalgic trip back to 1994. Oof. from philosophical rooftop hockey games to dead customers in the bathroom, we'll dive deep into the film's crude charm and its impact on indie filmmaking. So stock the Chewlies gum, argue about Star Wars, and clock in with us, lasagna not included. we are going to start, like we always do, by going around and asking everybody what their first experience was of watching Clerks, how it came to your attention, and can you remember the impact it had on you the first time you watched it? And because you're our guest, Michael, I'm going to come to you first and ask how you came across this film.
All right. Well, I was only 14 when it released, so I did not see it when it came out and got its original video and stuff like that. But I had just gotten a job in 1997 at Blockbuster Video. And I, when I was there, I had a customer. We were just talking about funny things. And they were like, hey, man, do you guys have this movie Clerks? And at the time, we didn't. And I was just like, no. And he goes, oh, man, it's Kevin Smith's, blah, 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 like that. And so I went to one of the small mom and pop video stores, you know, and and rented it, and that's how I first got into the View-Askew universe. And I, you know what? I'm actually lying. No, it's not. I had seen. What year was Chasing Amy?
Oh, 97, I think.
Okay. Chasing Amy was the one we had at Blockbuster, and I'd watched it, and I was talking to a customer about it, and he was like, hey, have you seen Clerks and Mallrats? And I was like, what are Clerks and Mallrats? And and then we had the conversation about that. So I went back and rented Clerks and then came back in at the same time. I think it was, so I watched them back to back. We had Mallrats at Blockbuster at the time. I think we'd only had one copy of Clerks and someone didn't return it. But so that's why I had to go somewhere else. But then so that was my introduction there. I mean, my introduction really was Chasing Amy, but. And I loved that movie, and then went back, and then I was brought into the lore and everything else like that, and then just huge fan ever since.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I did double check. Chasing Amy was definitely 1997. Yeah. I should know because it's my favorite Kevin Smith film, so that's probably why it's ingrained in my head. The year of release.
I thought it was. I thought I'd seen it first because I think it was a new release when I was working. Like it had just come out, and I was talking to a customer about it, and then he was like, "Well, have you seen Clerks?" So I was like, "Wait, what? What's that?" Oh, dude, you work in a video store. You need to watch Clerks.
Oh, my story is quite similar, but I'll get to it eventually. After I've asked you, DK, what was your first experience with Clerks? If you don't mind me asking, how did you come across it? And what did you think of it?
Well, I saw Mallrats first.
Right.
I was seeing a girl and her brother got Mallrats, and we sat there and we watched it. And, you know, obviously had Stan Lee, so I was all over that shit. And it wasn't until a couple of years later, I think, I was working in a store, and the people that were working in there, they had a Clerks postcard stuck to the till as a kind of warning, you know, which had the tagline, you know, just because they serve you doesn't mean they like you. And it was very much that kind of atmosphere, well, the Randall atmosphere in the shop. So I thought, oh, you know, I'll see what that's like. So hired it. I think it was from a decent video store, not a shitty one. And yeah, kind of fell in love with it. It kind of blew me away, so much so that I've mentioned this to you before, Mike, that when, you know, if there's a piece of music that you like and you listen to it and you listen to it and you listen to it, and then you just, after it all, you become so sick of it. It was kind of like that with this film because I just watched it so much. And, yeah, it led to a couple of not great situations in the real world. So my feelings have diluted a bit, but, yeah, at that point I was kind of obsessed. And it wasn't at that point when I watched it, I thought, holy shit, it's kind of like set in the same universe as Mallrats, because I didn't know about Kevin Smith. I didn't know, you know, about Jay and Silent Bob until that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of weird when you think that it's kind of like the first shared universe long before like MCU or anything like that.
Yeah.
But, weird. I'm assuming none of your bad experiences are the film's fault. It's not like you met one of the actors and they beat you up or anything like that.
No. It was a completely Caitlin Bree type thing.
Oh, okay. So, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, the ironic thing is, at the Midland Park Mall.
I was seeing a girl that worked in a video shop.
And
she was cheating on me with the guy in the video shop. I went into the video shop one day just to pick her up, and they were watching Clerks. And I remember saying to the guy, who I had no idea she was cheating on me with, saying, "Oh, you know, we've got Clerks, love it." It was actually my fucking copy that she'd taken down and lent to this dude.
Oh, I'm sorry that I shouldn't laugh, but that is brazen.
I was going to make a 37 joke, so that's at least.
I would imagine those are fucking small fry numbers, dude.
God, rookie numbers. Oh well, and now that person is married to an Asian design major. But anyway, moving on. No, weirdly enough, I was very late, comparatively speaking, to Clerks, because I'm from a little small, you know, village, town, whatever you want to call it, in Northumberland. So we're not very au fait with movies. So, and when I went off to university to do film studies, which I'm sure I've mentioned more than once, I always hate mentioning it because it sounds like,
take a humble folks.
But so I went off to university to do film studies, and my knowledge of film was basically, you know, huge blockbusters that had made it to you. My knowledge of indie film was basically non-existent. And it was when I was attending Freshers Week and just meeting everyone, met a lovely woman who became a friend through uni called Kim Wilson, no relation, but she was really nice, and we got talking about films we like, and she was talking about like, oh, and do you like Star Wars, and, you know, the importance of that and whatnot. And then she got talking about, she started quoting the thing about like, oh, what about all the contractors on the Death Star? And I was like, that's really mad. What made you think about that? And she was like, oh, it's Clerks, dude. You must have seen Clerks. And I had no idea what she was talking about. And then she was the one that basically told me about Clerks' existence and educated me on, oh, you must know Kevin Smith. Kevin Smith, the filmmaker, makes great comedy movies and everything. So, again, I had no idea. Went out and immediately found copies of, a copy of Clerks, first of all, and watched that and was like, this is really good. It's I can't believe I'd never heard of it, but I can understand why I didn't, because I mean, for starters, the fact that it's black and white means it would never have made it into into wide circulation around here. And as soon as anybody, my parents and my younger brother, for example, are just very much the kind of people that are like, black and white shite, I'm not going to watch that. So it's kind of, oh well, I guess you're not watching this film then. But I was slightly less precious and a bit more snobbery, I guess. So I watched it and loved it, and then randomly, this is not so much connected with Clerks, but I didn't get to any of the other Kevin Smith films until I was out one New Year's Eve with my friend Steve, and we got really, really drunk and were massively hungover the next morning. We'd had like 4 hours sleep, and we were like, we've got nothing to do because it's January the 1st, and we just decided we're going to run to the local video store, rent whatever we could randomly find, and just watch that. And we picked up some completely random movies just because we were like, oh, well, what's that? So I remember we watched like One Night at McCool's and things that are like absolutely dreadful movies that have made no cultural impact. And then because I recognized the character names, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back had just come out. And I was like, oh, Jay and Bob from Clerks, let's give this a go. And we both absolutely loved it. We thought it was hilarious, whether it was the pop culture references that had hit home or it was just the fact that we hadn't seen anything that was just balls to the wall comedy. We were just like, this is brilliant. And so with that being the second one, I was like, right, I'm going to go and I'm going to find all of Kevin Smith's films now and watch them. And so, sure enough, I watched Mallrats. I watched Chasing Amy, which, as I said, ended up as my favorite. Watched Dogma, and I've kind of not looked back since and been a diehard Kevin Smith fan, and try to, spread the word as much as I can, if necessary and if possible, amongst other people. Although he is more well known, in the circles I travel with now than he was. So yeah, and I was kind of annoyed because his latest, the 4:30 movie, just never made it to cinemas here, and I just found out it's available to rent digitally. So I think I might have to rent and watch that so I can at least see it. I know it's not view askew, but
It's one I've been watching too. I just haven't been able to get around to it yet.
Yeah, other than that, the way I have to say, I have had the fortune of seeing a few Kevin Smith films in the cinema since being a fan, specifically Clerks 2 and 3, which were both really good experiences. Although Clerks 3 was a very emotional experience to see on the big screen in the cinema. So, yeah.
I saw it with Kevin Smith. He was, when he went on his tour with it, and he comes to Charleston, and I saw it on the screen with him talking about it before and after, so it was even more emotional.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, if I could, I would, but not living in the States, we don't really get that whole thing. That's why the 4:30 movie never got a release, because he tends to do his things is like Fathom events and stuff, whereas you say it's kind of a roadshow around the various. Well,
4:30 though actually did get a release in the US, not like that. Like, it got a cinema release just on its own. Like, it wasn't one of the event things like he does with some of the other stuff. But that was just here in the US,
Yeah, well, I mean, it may have got a cinema release in some of the wider chains, but it certainly didn't make it anywhere near me. And I was keeping an eye out for it, but
yeah.
Oh well. Yeah, fair enough. As I see, I probably will end up getting it if I do love it on physical media, because I do that with all of the other Kevin Smith films that I've got. So that's fair enough. That's quite enough geeking out, I think. So back to the movie at hand, Clerks, which, it is relevant. It was Kevin Smith's debut writing and directing a big film. And we have some information about how that came about, along with some other things, in our usual behind-the-scenes section. Myself and DK are both going to handle that. I've written some stuff out for both of us today, so you won't have to listen to just one of us. So without further ado, I'm going to jump in and start off telling you about this film and the behind-the-scenes. I'll tell you that Clerks was released, as we said, in October of 1994, almost exactly 30 years ago, and it's both Kevin Smith's directorial debut and the first in his ongoing shared universe, named the View Askew Universe after his production company View Askew. As such, it also introduces several characters, almost all of whom would recur at some point in future movies, with the most notable, of course, being Jay and Silent Bob, played by Jason Mewes and Smith himself, respectively. The film, believe it or not, cost $25,575 to shoot. Kevin Smith financed the film by maxing out several credit cards and selling his comic book collection, which he's mostly since bought back, I should say. He also borrowed $3,000 from his parents, spent a portion of funds he got back from his college paychecks from working at Quick Stop and RST Video, and used insurance money awarded for property of his that was damaged in a storm flood. The movie was filmed in black and white, partly because they filmed in the actual old convenience store where Smith used to work. As it's still a functioning store, they had to film during the night hours when it was closed. That's also the reason for the gum in the locks excuse to explain the shutters being closed, as of course it wasn't actually open. And a couple of Smith's friends and colleagues ended up playing multiple roles in this film. Scott Mosier, who was the producer and editor of the film, plays William Black, the angry hockey playing customer and the angry mourner. Walt Flanagan, Smith's childhood friend, is woolen cap smoker, egg-obsessed guidance counselor, offended customer, and cat-admiring bitter customer. On top of this, he also appeared as the final RST video customer in a deleted scene. Smith never intended for Flanagan to play this many roles, but the actors he got to play them just did not show up, and he would often in jest refer to Flanagan as the Lon Chaney of the 90s. Flanagan would appear in Smith's subsequent films as Walt the Fanboy Grover. So, yeah, that's what I have. Over to you, DK.
Randall and the happy, scrappy hero pop lady are not actually in the same room at the same time. Jeff Anderson refused to read the list of porno movies in front of her, and particularly in front of the child, although the reaction shots of the lady herself were obtained by reading the list to her. In the original ending, Dante was going to be killed by a robber, giving a tragic sadness to his repeated complaints that he was not supposed to be there and reflecting back to the conversation earlier about the Empire Strikes Back and down endings. The extended cut also reveals the fact that Randall disabled the security cameras for the hockey game, which would have added to this tragedy since the perpetrator would presumably therefore never be identified and caught. And it's often regarded as a cult classic and a landmark in independent filmmaking. The film was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry, take a drink everyone, by the Library of Congress in 2019 as being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
Hey, at this point it would be easier to try and look at films we've reviewed that haven't been added to the Library of Congress, I think.
Yeah.
Comes up a lot. So, yeah. Anything there that particularly stood out as something you didn't know that you found interesting, Michael?
I got something else to add with one of the things. I don't know if you did. The other reason they shot in black and white was because of the color temperature of the lights inside. They could not, because they didn't have the ability to light everything correctly and do all that. There was everything when they were first messing with it was coming up green, which is a problem with certain old fluorescent lights with camera stuff. I've actually had that problem on a set before that we had to figure out and get it lit correctly to do that. They didn't have the time and or ability to do that. And Dave Klein, the DP, who's gone on to do tons and tons of big things, like Mandalorian and shit like that, this was his one of his first things. He basically was like, well, if we shoot in black and white, we won't have that problem.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, okay.
But, yeah, that's cool.
So Kevin's like, let's do it fucking black and white.
Yeah.
And that's I knew most all of that, though, that you guys had said.
I figured you would, yeah.
I've dug deep on Kevin Smith.
So. Oh, I figured, yeah. I mean, it's not anything that Kevin Smith fans wouldn't know, but I just think it's fascinating if you're not aware, particularly in terms of the scrappy way of getting it made, which I'm sure, I mean, Kevin Smith's talked about a lot in kind of interviews and his various kind of stage shows and things, how, you know, it was a gamble and it was a question of, like I said, maxing out credit cards, using everything he had, and it still was only a budget which, you know, it's pathetic by movie-making standards, well, you know, under $30,000.
It is. I wish I had $30,000 for a feature.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wish I had $30,000 just to hand. But
in general. One of the things I didn't know, though, that was said was I didn't know that Jeff Anderson didn't read those porno titles in front of the actor. Yeah. I didn't know that.
And the black and white thing, though, it was, as you said, partly because of the lighting, because they were... I mean, it feels harsh to use the word, but they were very much amateur filmmakers at this point.
Oh, for sure.
And so they were just doing the best they could. I noticed even in the credits where it's listing all the various roles, and under boom mic operator, it just says whoever grabbed the pole. So it's just like there was nobody specific. It was just whoever was there on the day willing to hold it. So, yeah, it was that kind of thing. But I will say, obviously, the shutters were closed partly because the store was closed, and partly because if they were open, you'd be able to tell even in black and white that it's clearly night outside.
Yes.
But I will add to that Kevin Smith has said, even though it wasn't intentional, the fact that it's in black and white kind of does also give you the appearance of the security cameras, which is a kind of happy coincidence that it's almost filmed as if you're watching it through the cameras themselves of the store. And I was like, oh, I never even thought of that. But I guess, yeah, I suppose it does give you that impression in a sense. So yeah, with the behind the scenes out the way, we're going to jump into the sections that we always discuss. If you're new to us, that would be things like writing, plot, directing, acting, VFX, production design, music and sound, and then we'll get to the other things and our kind of wrap-ups, favorite things and conclusions. So, we'll begin with the writing / plot. And I think, DK, you've got some things to start us off, some facts and figures, as it were, here with that.
I do,
just a couple
of
little things.
When writing the script, writing director Kevin Smith based the character of Dante Hicks on himself, Randall Graves on his friend Brian Johnson, who appeared in Smith's subsequent films of as Steve Dave Polsky, and Jay on Jason Mewes, who ended up playing him in the movie. Smith originally wrote the part of Randall for himself, dryly admitting in the DVD audio commentary to be the reason why he gave Randall his most liked lines. However, Smith found that writing, directing, working at the star, and playing a lead role all simultaneously was too difficult. Sounds like you, Mike. And he constantly forgot his lines in the process, so he gave the role of Randall to his friend Jeff Anderson, while Smith took on the less demanding role of Silent Bob.
Yeah, obviously not that many lines there to remember.
No.
We'll jump in then and talk about the writing of the film. And DK, I came to the guest first last time, so I'm going to come to you. Is there anything that specifically stands out that you wanted to bring up first of all about the writing or the plot of Clerks?
I just love the inconsequential conversations that, you know, people have when in a work environment. It captures essentially what it is like working in a store. And I think that experience is kind of like a global one. So it resonates with a lot of people who's been in this situation as yourself. You were in a store and, you know, you suffered that kind of thing, and so was I. And yeah. I think if you've ever worked in the retail industry, this captures it perfectly. And I think that's why it holds up so well. And I think that's why a lot of people kind of flock to it, because you do end up talking about shit. And
yeah,
you do end up having arguments about Star Wars, and you end up having arguments about, you know, how customers act and all that kind of thing. And yes, this does take it to the extreme with certain situations such as the funeral and the hockey match, but it's not that extreme. You find yourself in explicably strange situations when you are working in the retail sector. And I think this adequately kind of captures that in a nutshell. And I think that's why it's done so well. And yeah, love the conversations in this, and they're the highlight of the movie for me.
Yeah, because it seems like naturalistic, incongruous conversations. I mean, obviously it is written. It's not a film that is, as far as I'm aware, you know, improvised in its entirety. But as somebody who's worked that kind of job, as are you, as you said, we've had these conversations, you know what I mean? Oh, so many times. It's relatability, I think, is the strength of it, because it's like, oh, God, we've had these seemingly meaningless conversations, these complaining, these moaning about things. We've had these flipping annoying customers that come in. And yeah, I've always said Dante is probably one of my most, if not my most relatable movie character, because, oh God, I've been there so many times working in a very similar job to this one. So yeah. What about you then, Michael? Anything that stands out? Perhaps even from a filmmaker point of view, is the writing.
Oh, from a fan's point of view first, like, this was the first movie I had ever seen that had people talk like me and my friends talk. And that's where the writing really hit home to me. I'm just like, oh, this is... And on top of it, I did also work in a video store at the time, too. So, like, I mean, that hit even more closer to home, you know, working at a retail establishment. Even if it was a big video store, it was not a mom and pop, but it was still a... Yeah. You know, that kind of setting. But yeah, the dialogue just has always been, to me, just like, oh, he has his people speak like me and my friends talk. And I didn't hear that all the time. And in movies, you know, there's good dialogue and stuff, but it wasn't just like how me and my friends give each other the shit and how we, you know, like busting each other's balls and just how we talk and having smart conversations about stupid things. Or inconsequential things, as you guys have said. It's that's what really hit home to me about it when I first watched it, and the many other times I've watched. And watch Clerks cool. and all of his other movies.
Yeah, and is there anything on the kind of technical way that I think it's kind of written or anything that particularly stands out to you as kind of a strength?
Not necessarily that stands out. Well, I mean, just his ability to write real people having real conversations, like, is one of his strengths. And, like,
yeah.
having the conversations mean nothing and everything all at the same time. And, you know, we could be yeah. talking about absolutely nothing, but have a, you know, a deeper, better meaning behind it. Like, Kevin Smith excels at that. And that's what, you know, this was the start of his journey of doing that over and over and over again, no matter how, even if it has a movie with a rubber poop monster, it still means something.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And,
yeah.
and so, like, that's really where he, like, I mean, he, the best thing that he does probably is write. He's a great director. I love stuff he does, but his biggest strength is his writing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a unique opinion, but absolutely, I think, like you said, everyone has said it. It's the way he captures the voice, perhaps, of a generation, and certainly yeah. he captures the way people talk outside of, you know, it doesn't feel like scripted dialogue. That's why I said earlier, like, you yeah. might be mistaken for thinking he had a rough idea and then had everyone improvise. No, it wasn't that. It was just that it sounds like the kinds of conversations that you would have. But I have to say, for me as well, it's also a strength because it's the old saying of dying's easy and comedy's hard. This wasn't just a question of writing, you know, a movie as if it were a drama or whatever. He had to write a comedy, all of the kind of, you know, structure and tropes and ideas of comedy in there as well. And so for me, I think one of the strengths is the way he has, like, running jokes going on mm-hmm. throughout the script. So things call back, even if they are not like necessarily funny, but they become funny through repetition, like the constant sort of, why does it smell like shoe polish joke? Again, we've all been in situations like that where it's something ridiculous and silly and you don't want to have to explain it 4,000 times. But everybody that comes in is just like, why does it smell like, oh yeah, because of the sign you've been past, you know, whatever. So I like that. And I just love the way that he structures what could almost be the comedy sketches, like the individual scenes. One of the ones I kind of zeroed in on was the conversation, obviously, between Dante and Veronica, when, you know, he's sitting having, you know, just a nice chill out with her, and then they get talking about how many people they've slept with, and she kind of angrily storms out because of the whole, you know, suck 37 dicks, etc. I just love the way that entire scene plays out because it starts innocuous, it gradually builds and builds. And it has such a great comedy button on the end of it, which is just like, I wish I had the genius for comedy of the way that, you know, she storms off like, I've got to go to class. This is the end of it. And a lot of filmmakers would end it there. It's the end of the conversation. But it's the way he kind of busts out of the door and screams, oh, I try not to suck any dicks on the way through the parking lot. And then the chap that's like waiting for the shop just turns around and starts following her. And he's like, hey, you get back here.
Get back here. Yeah, that's one of my favorite jokes.
I love the line. My girlfriend sucked 37 dicks. In a row?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, that's what I mean. Just things like that, which you add to it, which is just like, it's already funny and you punctuate it so well with like, oh yeah, that's a doozy of a line, you know? So I think that's just brilliant. Or even like, the very first time I watched it, like I was genuinely like, I don't know why this is funny, and I certainly don't agree necessarily with the kind of sentiment of it, but the guy who was, you know, very seemingly anti-smoking, but it was just because he was trying to plug chewing gum. And I was like, oh, that is funny. Because at first you're very much on his side. And I'm very much an anti kind of, you know, smoking kind of guy anyway. That it's kind of, you know, yeah, he's not doing this for altruistic reasons. He just works for Chewy's gum and he's trying to get them to not buy cigarettes, but buy gum instead. Which I thought was absolutely hilarious of a way of, you know, bringing that conversation. And again, you know, we've been in this thing where it's like, yeah, we've got to do this, dude. And the way this guy's like, wow, you know, who else was just following orders? The Nazis. And you're like, oh, shut up, go away. And again, the button on that is just the fact that the guy's bringing out all the diseased lugs and the horrible pictures. And you've still got that one guy who then, you know, once they've all dispersed, just comes to the counter and he's like, a pack of cigarettes. As he's coughing his guts out. And it's Dante, almost unbelieving Dante. It's just like, well, there you go. It's brilliant. Like I said, all of the bits of it are organized really well. And within themselves, I think you could watch them, like I said, scenes like that or the Star Wars scene. You could watch them as their own thing or as like a sketch, and I think they work really well. But the film, you know, it's designed to be watched as a whole, and it tells you a beautiful day in the life story, I think. But yeah, I think Is there anything else that particularly stands out? Any kind of jokes or bits that you guys particularly thought worked well, or that that you thought were a highlight for you?
I thought when I first saw the movie that this joke wasn't real until I literally had it happen to me. But when the customer standing in front of a sign at a video store yep. asking for something, standing literally under the sign, mm-hmm. that happened to me at Blockbuster. And what's even funnier about it is, like, in the U.S., people will be like, hey, where are your movies to buy? Where are your movies for sale? And we had a sign that said movies to buy, and someone literally, like, no, they weren't joking. They had not looked at it. They just came in, and then, like, visually, they're standing in front of me directly under the sign going, hey, where are your movies to buy?
Yeah.
Instead of for sale. And I'm like, are you messing with me? And they're like, no. Like, I mean, I didn't just immediately go, oh, right over there. Like, because I thought it was a joke. I thought somebody was pulling a prank on me.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, oh, like, right behind you are the movies to buy. They're like, oh, okay, thanks. Turned around and walked over. They 100% weren't joking. And it was just like, I was like, I can't believe someone actually did that. And then they said it how we have it written, which is not what people ever come in and do. Hey, do you have any movies for, where are your movies for sale? Is what they would say. And this person verbatim did the sign. So that always just stuck out to me in the video store. One of the video store montages in Clerks is that.
I mean, it's a small moment, but yeah, not just the video store. I mean, the woman that's like, how much is this anyway? And it's got four or five different prices in large. And that has happened in my job. Like I said, it's you think it couldn't possibly be true if you've never worked retail, but the amount of times that we've had like a shelf unit or whatever full of books for sale and a massive thing, like a top header of it with like everything on this rack is £7 or £8 or whatever. And then I've been told I have to go and sticker every book individually because people just will not read the massive sign that tells you how much everything is. They will individually pick up a book, bring it and say, this doesn't have a price on it. So yeah, people really are just
that dumb. Reading in retail is astounding.
Yeah, exactly.
Like people just refusing to read any sign whatsoever.
Yeah.
It's just that was one of the things that I had to learn when I started retail.
I mean, I do think Randall is an exaggerated version of it, and I wouldn't do half the things he does for the reasons he does. But the amount of times I've really wanted to sort of do the equivalent of, nice cat, what's it called? Annoying customer. It's like, well, screw you. Yeah. In terms of the writing as well, I have to say, this film is notable as, you know, this isn't really news to anybody, but it's worth mentioning as being the first time of many Kevin Smith films that starts bringing in pop culture references. So we've mentioned, like I said, many times the whole Star Wars conversation about, you know, the innocent contractors on the Death Star and then, you know, the hilarious guy who's like, no, those contractors knew what they were getting into. I could have done a mob job, and comparing that to Star Wars. I'm not going to repeat everything because hopefully you've seen the film if you're listening to this, but I think that was great. But on top of that, you've also got references to like Jaws with the salsa shark, Indiana Jones is referenced at one point, Navy SEALs is referenced negatively, you know, when he's talking about like people always want to rent the dumbest shit. Ooh, Navy SEALs. One thing I did want to ask is, how do you guys feel about the writing of the characters rather than the situations they're in? We get a lot of characters in here, and they're very different types. Dante, Randall, the two women, obviously, that in Dante's life, being the only ones, I mean, other than Jay and Silent Bob, are there for... They don't do a lot in this movie just yet, but they have a couple of nice moments. So what do you feel about the way the characters are written, and do you have anything stand out, you know, amongst there or that you think is a strength? And Michael, I'll come to you first on that one.
I mean, I really, I know that Randall is an exaggeration version of Kevin Smith and stuff, and just some of the stuff he wrote was what he wanted to do to customers, but of course never did. But I think it was great, but I really do like Dante's character and how it was written, and also what Brian O'Halloran brought to it. Like, I don't know, like, specifically why, but it's always just resonated with me as a... you know, a reluctant guy who always tries to do his best, but isn't always in the best situations to be able to do it. Like he's ultimately a good person who's made poor choices. And I don't know. I just something about that resonated with me more than any of the other ones. Like, you know, it's like, I always felt like, oh, I wanted to, because I was in a video store, I wanted to be Randall, but I was Dante, I guess is the best way that, that I felt when watching it. And yeah, just like, oh yeah, I'm the guy who's going to come in and help out. And I'm not even supposed to be here today, but you know, I am. But I guess that's why it resonated more with me. So I felt more of a kinship to Dante because of that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the kind of strengths I would say about the character, specifically of Dante and Randall, is that I'm with you. I was very much the Dante. I was the pushover, the kind of guy that would complain constantly about it, but still do everything and still be willing to help everyone. And even with that customer, you know, that ultimately leads to the, you know, having sex with a corpse type joke. But the way he's initially just pushing and pushing, and Dante is still just like, yeah, you can use the bathroom. Yeah, okay, you can use the soft toilet roll. Yeah, you can use the dirty magazine, whatever. And he's just giving in to every one of his demands more and more. And you just know it's like, dude, just tell him to F off. You know what I mean? But then you're just like, would I? Probably not. I'd probably just be like him and be like, whatever. I don't care. You know? Yeah. I'm not even meant to be here. So who cares what you do? And, yeah, like I said, just giving in to everybody's stuff and putting up with Randall's crap as much as he doesn't really want to admit it. And yeah, but Randall, as you said, is very much the other side of that coin, is like, I'd love to be like this. Acknowledge how crap the job is. You know, tell the customers exactly what I think of them. Just be as, you know, laissez-faire about these things. You know, it's his job to do it. And yet when the woman's like, are any of these any good? I don't know. I don't watch movies. It's kind of, oh, yeah. And then to, you know, to make himself look better when she's like, well, I'm not coming here again, bursts out the door like, and you're not allowed to rent here. And Jay's like, yeah, like he's done something amazing. Yeah, I do kind of wonder sometimes how the heck he's still in the job, like how he still works there, but never mind. Yeah. So what about you, Dickie? Is anything character-wise that sounds? It doesn't have to be those two. I mean, I know that there's very much two kind of archetypes of women that I think it's important that they're two very different types of women that you get here. And I think it says a lot about Dante's character that he doesn't recognize how good he's got it with his actual girlfriend, and pines for, let's be honest, a bit of a bitch. That we've kind of we've all known women like that maybe once or twice in our lives, you know?
I do like the fact that for the most part of the movie, you do think Randall's just kind of an annoying prick and just gets his jollies just by being that annoying prick. And it's not until the entire situation with Caitlin that he actually, you know, when he says to her and says, you know, you mess with her again, I'll kill you, nothing personal, that he actually does give a shit about Randall. About Dante. And then, you know, after they have that little fight in the store and Dante's on about, you know, he's yet again complaining. And then Randall just kind of gives him both barrels and says, look, basically, whatever you're getting up to is your own fault. And it kind of turns the situation on its head. And yeah, Dante can be a bit too much of a pushover, but he is kind of thinking about screwing around on his girlfriend. So... Yeah, I do like the you know, the moral voice in the end comes from Randall.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think I've often, when I've been kind of that annoying Mona type Dante character, I've often thought of the way that Randall, as much as it's really cruel, it's one of those kind of cruel to be kind, you know, home truth situations, the way he screams like, listen to yourself, or you're not supposed to be here. You sound like an asshole. Just shit or get off the pot. It's, you know, you're the one in control of your life. You know, and yes, I've related to Dante the way he's like, well, it's not that easy. And he's like, of course it is. Just fucking quit if you want to quit. Like, it's not that easy. Of course it isn't. But at the same time, you're in control of your life. You can do what you want. You know, if you want to go and get another job, look for one, do it, go out and make a difference. But don't just spend all your time here moaning about it. And like you said, I think Randall, deep down, he does want, like Veronica, he wants kind of something more for Dante. He doesn't want him to be stuck there as much as he kind of enjoys having that company. You know, I think he senses as well he's destined maybe for a bit more, whatever might ultimately happen. And, you know, we know how it ends up, but I do think he's not as much of an arsehole as he appears. And perhaps there's a little bit of Kevin Smith in that, you know, as well. Yeah. The way that the character's written like him is like, you know, I can be a little bit harsh sometimes, but ultimately I care, I give a damn, you know. So, yeah. But what about the two lady characters then at DK? Like I said, we've known women like both of them, and I don't know if you have the same experience as me, but I always find myself like internally screaming at Dante about like basically like what Silent Bob says at the end, like, realize how good you've got it with Veronica. You know, she's very much not an unattractive woman. She absolutely dotes over you. and you've got it really good. So why are you pining for this chick who's clearly just going to fuck you over? You know, so
I don't know, but I've been in that kind of situation, and you can't help but be Dante sometimes, as self-defeating as that is. I could kind of see where he's coming from. But even now, as you say, you just think, just don't do it, dude. Looking back on it with some experience, and you just think, come on.
Yeah.
Grass so, is not greener.
No, exactly. I think they both play their roles incredibly well. I think Caitlin is... she is written as a bit of a bitch. Let's be fair. Not just the cheating stuff, but the whole way she talks about her current Asian design major fiance. It's really like, you know, I don't really give a shit about anybody but me. So you do kind of take...
You say that, but I also think one of the strengths of the way she's played is that you can absolutely see how Dante would kind of fall for it, because when she actually turns up in person and makes the effort to, I find myself almost believing her when she's like, look, this is why this happened. I would never have done. I'm going to break up with him. I kind of do want to be with you. And I'm like, demon, witch. You know, I've been in this situation. I'm finding myself believing you, and I know it's stupid of me. But yeah.
Yeah, because we are basically, our brains sometimes are in our underpants. So
you, or in our heart, if you want to be a bit nicer about it, but yeah.
No, let's be fair. So yeah, I mean, as well as the those conversations and working in a shot, he does get this. We are a fool to ourselves, basically, some of the times. And Dante is the kind of epitome of that, because there's absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever with Veronica, as you've said. She's
no,
you know, she's a diamond, as it were. You know, apart from the 37 thing, but
I'm kind of on her side with that as well, you know.
So we are idiots. Men are idiots. Let's be fair.
No, I'm totally on her side with that as well. It's right what she says, that like, yeah, whatever. You've slept with 12 people. I've only slept with 2. Okay, I've done other stuff, but I've only ever slept with people that I love. And him getting so bent out of shape because of his stupid thing about like, oh, every time I kiss you, it's been on like other guys. And even the kind of hilarious way that Randall put it in perspective. He said, at least he wasn't number 36. It's just kind of like, see, you realize how stupid you're being. Exactly. So sorry, you were saying, Michael, anyway.
I was just basically agreeing with, I mean, like, it doesn't matter. Like, I mean, that's one of the things that Kevin Smith, even when writing characters in this and then future movies of what Chasing Amy, was like, he's got to get over himself. It doesn't matter what someone's done in the past. It matters what they're doing now, which is also what is the point of this movie as well, is that, you know, Veronica was the one doing something now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. But she even has that dialogue, though, where she says, like, okay, I've been with 36 guys, but you're number 37. And that goes to show, you know, you're the most recent and there's been nobody since, which, in case you're too dumb to figure it out, means I'm being faithful to you. So what does it matter? You know what I mean? At that point.
Yeah. What someone's done in the past has no bearing on what they're doing now and in the future.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there's a caveat to that. Like, if they're like, oh, I've got a STD of some kind or something like that.
Ultimately the reveal, I've murdered somebody in the past or whatever. Yeah. Then, okay.
Well, no, I've murdered everybody I've been with in the past, but no, I mean, I haven't murdered you yet.
Situation.
There's small caveats. For the most part, it doesn't matter what someone's done in the past.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, certainly not in relationships in the past. Yes, I think that's the point, isn't it? Because again, that's one of the things I think Kevin Smith's good at, is writing like relationships, particularly obviously more so kind of heterosexual male-female relationships. It always rings true that it's situations that I've either been in or I've seen people in, or I can just find relatable. And so, yeah, I think that's what the big lesson from this one is, just, it doesn't matter what you've done in relationships in the past. If you two are together, devoted to each other and genuinely care, just why get hung up about it? It's stupid. Yeah. And like I said, I find it, even though it wasn't supposed to be his line, I do find it poignant that he's the one that delivers the line. You know, there's a million fine looking women in the world, dude, but they don't all bring you lasagna at work. Some of them just cheat on you. You know, it's a great line.
Yeah. And you know, again, it's when you come down to it, Dante's doing this to himself, he's a bit of a prick. He's all right going on about Veronica, about the 37 dicks thing, but all while this is happening, he's planning to cheat on her.
Exactly, yeah. Which is how he ultimately ends up losing her. And like you said, I think Randall was trying to look out for him with that thing. And even at the end when he's like, I think I've realized that I am in love with Veronica, so I'm going to have to go and try to talk to her and explain it. And then maybe, you know, it's Randall who points out, well, you could still have Caitlin if you really want to, even though, you know, this horrible thing's happened and whatever. It's like, look, she'll get over it. You know, again, it's one of the best lines when he's like, oh, she fucked a dead guy. My mom's been fucking a dead guy for the last 15 years of their relationship, you know. She'll get over it. So, I mean, he could have, I think, is the point there. He ultimately had to decide which of the two girls he wanted, but lost them both because it was dog with two bones kind of situation. So, yeah. But it's just really good slice of life and relatable characters, I think, is the point. And even Jay and Silent Bob, as much as they aren't people that I've ever been, I've so known people like that who just seem so carefree and so not bothered and hang around outside and stuff and just chill out and smoke and dance around. And I always find it fascinating every time I hear, because he's mentioned it many times in his Evening with Kevin Smith and stuff, that the character of Jay is literally just Jason Mewes because he was like, yeah, he can't believe this guy. Like, Jason Mewes wasn't somebody he knew. He was introduced to him by, you know, a friend of his who was a friend of his, and then he kind of, you know, found himself in his friend group. And Kevin Smith, I think, says, I was all primed and ready to hate this guy because he wasn't part of the original friend group. And he tells the story about how Jay's just, you know, he's a ball of energy and he's running around. And I don't know if you guys know this story, but I just think it's hilarious how he said, like, they were at an arcade just having fun and running around. And he proceeded to watch Jay, like, fake fellatio on every one of the arcade joysticks in this place they were at. And then come to one of those things that had, like, a roller thing instead of a joystick. And then thought to himself, what's he going to do here? And then watched as Jay basically proceeded to lick out this, like, ball joystick on the arcade machine. Oh, and was just like, and that was the very moment that I realized this guy's a genius and I love him and I want him to be my friend forever. And so that's kind of like, he wrote the character as just like, this isn't a character, this is just Jay Mewes. That's what he's like. So, I'm like, that's brilliant, man. That's awesome.
It's a great story, but it was at the community center, not an arcade. But...
community center, that's the one. Yeah. So, I knew you'd know because I knew you would have heard the story many times.
Oh, yeah, I'm familiar with the story.
Yeah. So,
yeah, because he went around the room, and it wasn't just all because they just had an arcade machine in there. He went around, like, the flagpole and, like, everything in the room and was doing fake fellatio on it and then got to the arcade with a rollerball on it.
Exactly. Awesome. No, I would definitely, I mean, it's a side note, but if you haven't seen The Evening with Kevin Smith, the DVDs and things, they're incredible. It's like 3 hours long and it flies by, and the man is as brilliant a raconteur and storyteller as he is as kind of writing for films. And it's fascinating hearing everything about, you know, everything from his attempt at a Superman script to how he met everyone to how he funded Clerks and beyond. So a random plug for those while we're talking about Clerks. Yes.
I knew we were talking about Clerks. There was something from earlier that I wanted to do. The credit card debt that he racked up too. He was getting credit cards in the name acting like he was the business owner of the video store.
Oh wow! Okay, I didn't know that.
Like, part. He was like, he would put down that he was like made an exorbitant amount of money a year as running the video store, so they would give him more credit. And so he took out credit cards underneath. I mean, they're underneath his name, obviously, but like he was lying about, and then like had person like play a fake in case anybody wanted to verify who it is. That he would verify that yes, that's who it is, and he makes $90,000 a year. You know, in 1990.
Yikes. Yeah, probably best not to do that if you're a filmmaker. By all means, follow your dreams, but don't do that.
For sure. He got lucky and was able to pay it off.
Absolutely. I mean, there's more we could say about, I think, the writing, but we've said a lot and we've kind of covered everything. I'm going to move to, I think, the acting next, because why not? We've basically hit on it by talking about the characters. And I have a little bit on the acting to start us off as well. I'll just let you know that it's kind of related to what I was already talking about with regards to Jay. Jason Mewes, who plays Jay, is not in any of the photo shoots for Clerks. Miramax, who bought the film's distribution rights following its run at Sundance Film Festival, believed that Jay had no commercial appeal and would scare audiences rather than entice them. Obviously, they were proved very wrong by the time you got to a film that had Jay and Silent Bob in the title of it. And I kind of alluded to this earlier because I thought I'd mentioned it, but it's come up here. Silent Bob's one poignant line was originally meant to be delivered by Jay, but Jason Mewes had such trouble delivering it, as we can see, he stumbles over the lines beforehand in the film, So Kevin Smith just decided to see it himself, which ultimately begins a runner of quote-unquote silent Bob, usually breaking his silence to say one or two important things in each of his future appearances. In this film and Mallrats, he speaks only once, but in Dogma and Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, he speaks twice. In Chasing Amy, he speaks once, but he does have quite a long speech. So, yeah. And they're always great, I think, as well. Yeah. So, yeah. Anything about the acting that you guys wanted to say that we haven't already kind of touched upon?
Yeah, I said pretty much all mine when I talked about the characters.
Yeah.
So I mean, I thought everybody was good. Like especially for a first time independent film actors, like mostly from stage and local stuff. I thought everybody did great.
Since we're on the topic of Jay, I will say that he still does strike me as a bit amateur at this point, if I'm being hypercritical. Like, you can kind of tell at this point he's not an actor, and as he kind of, you know, gets more and more roles in Kevin Smith films, I think he's certainly grown into a very passable actor now in other things and everything as well. But at this point, yeah, he does strike me as very stiff almost, I guess, on camera. And yes, you can tell that he messes up his lines, even though they keep it in the film at that one point, just before Kevin Smith delivers the line as well.
Yeah. Well, the first quite a few films, the drug use had a lot to do with that. But he's he's been clean and sober now for quite a few years and started taking acting seriously. And like, I thought he did great in Reboot. You know, I thought I was like, oh yeah, he's actually trying to become a good actor. So,
I mean,
like,
if you've ever seen Method in the Madness, which is his film, I think he's really good.
It's one that I've met, and I don't think I've seen it. But I remember hearing about it, and just one of those that I just didn't remember to, like, oh, I need to go back and watch that.
I do recommend it. It's really good. And he's incredible in it. But yeah, I think, like I said, he's grown into it, and I can certainly see why Kevin Smith would, you know, especially as an amateur filmmaker, put all your friends in there and have as much support around you as you can potentially get, you know.
Well, it's not only that, too, is people you find funny, but also one of the, like, with film is one of the largest collaborative art forms, and doing it with people you like and stuff like that is important. Like, I mean, that's why, like, people are like, he just makes movies to put his friends in them. And just like, he wants to make a movie that he thinks they're talented, he thinks they're funny, and he wants other people to see that too. And he thinks it'll help him make the story. So that's why he works. And honestly, in Hollywood, that is why a lot of directors use same people over and over again, is because they think they will do what they want. They like working with them. They have a great relationship, and they put them in there.
When you're an independent filmmaker, it's your own money. So, you know, if you're willing to do it, what the heck?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like, if you're doing it, you put your own money in there. Like, I mean, granted, yes, if you keep putting someone in there that you know can't act, they're asking you and wanting to do that, then it's going to start to show. But, like, he just thinks Jay's funny, and that's why he put him in stuff, and then made the character small, and not thought he would be able to corral him enough to do that. So,
yeah,
which he did.
But they're an interesting thing. I mean, they're there really just as kind of, you know, a world building, like, comic relief type thing in all of the first movies, as you say, until they get given their own one. But it just works. It's a nice break from kind of the ongoing plot line. They don't, like I said, at first get really that much character development or that much to do, but they're just there as a way of building out that world and being something that you can laugh at and find relatable in the way. I said, if you're not that person, you definitely know those people and you can be like, oh yeah, that's that guy that hangs around on the, you know, on the corner or does such and such or whatever. And it's just fun to watch, I guess. I will say as well, I forgot to mention during my notes, the milkmaid who's checking all the milk for dates is actually Kevin Smith's mum, Grace. Which, speaking of putting anyone in your movie that you can when you're given the chance. And I think whilst I'm talking about the acting parts, I think everybody does a really good job, particularly because they come across so real and naturalistic. But I did find Marilyn Gigliotti to be a tiny bit stiff at times as well. Again, that's me being really proper critical, and I think it's also because she gets the hardest monologues and long dragged on sentences. So initially I was like, she started off a bit stiff, but then towards the end I'm like, nah, she's actually like delivering really rapid paced dialogue and pages upon pages of it, and I couldn't do this. So I feel bad almost for the initial criticism, because my word, she's kind of crushing this. And so I felt a bit bad about the initial criticism I'd written. And I will say, I was very sad to learn, I didn't learn this until just this review, that Lisa Spoonhauer, who played Caitlin, had passed away a few years ago. So very sad to hear, man. RIP. Not that long ago, I think it was 2019, maybe 2017, something like that. So not all that long, which is a shame. So, yeah, but I think she was very good. Like I said, she was very convincing in the role of a woman who you find yourself, like, yeah, when she's not on screen, you're like, ooh, that woman's, she should be avoided, she's evil. And then when she's on screen, you're like, actually, I believe everything you're saying. So, yeah. The one other quick thing I wanted to bring up, I probably should have mentioned it, but it kind of falls under acting, directing, and writing. Have either of you guys seen the lost scene from the Clerks X DVD or the Blu-ray?
Yes.
No, the lost scene, as in the they wanted to film apparently the scene of what happens at the funeral that they attend, or the wake, but it would have been way too cost prohibitive. But they did eventually end up animating it in the style of Clerks the Animated Series, and so it's on the DVD and Blu-ray as an extra feature that you can watch it on its own, or you can watch the film with it reincorporated back in. What happens at that wake, and it is wild. It's absolutely silly. So I'm assuming you haven't seen it then, DK.
I haven't seen that one, no.
Okay, it's worth a look up. I won't, spoil too much
you
about it, but it's
probably find it on YouTube.
Oh yeah, almost certainly for sure. But yeah, it's nice because you get an Alyssa cameo in there from Chasing Amy, which isn't in the movie proper, and just you can see why it's stuff that they probably not just couldn't have done for cost, but stuff that you couldn't get away with outside of animation because it gets very extreme and weird. But it's not PC, but very funny, let's put it that way. And you can certainly see why the film picks up with them being chased out almost with pitchforks from the wake at the end. So yeah, awesome. So any thoughts then on the acting before I move into the direction and talking a little bit about that?
No, nothing else from me.
Nope.
Cool. When it comes to direction, then, one of the things that's notable about the film is that it is separated into segments, which obviously have their own titles that come up on screen. There are 9 of them, which are supposed to represent the 9 circles of hell in Dante, which is why the character is also named that. So something I had no idea about, but when I found out, was just like, that locks so many things into place. Yeah. That makes so much sense now. The film apparently was shot in 21 days with 2 additional pickup days. And because, as I've said, Smith was working at Quickstop during the day and shooting the film at night, he frequently slept no more than an hour a day. By the end of the 21-day shoot, Smith was apparently unable to stay awake while the fight between Dante and Randall was being shot. So, yeah, he was probably asleep when somebody else was filming that at the time. If you ever watch that and you want to know what's going on. So, any thoughts then on the directing before I get into my bits and pieces? Or did anything there shock you, I guess? Michael, I'll ask you first.
No, I mean, I've heard a lot of that, and, I've heard a bunch of that, so that didn't shock me, but, I mean, I think he's one of my favorite directors, one of the reasons why I'm a filmmaker, so, like, I mean, I've got nothing but praise for the gentleman, and in this movie, I mean, doing what he did that much, I mean, he had a vision, and what directing is, so you have a vision and leading and getting other people to help you fulfill that, and I think he did it exactly, like, I mean, it wasn't exactly how he had pictured originally, but part of filmmaking is making concessions on things like black and white thing we talked about, and different decisions that are out of your control because you aren't Disney with an unlimited budget. You're you can only do so much, but I mean you have a vision and make it and put it through from paper to screen. I mean, with him writing, directing, and editing, like, I mean, it's completely his vision. So, like, I mean, I thought he did great and did exactly what he intended to do. So,
Yeah, couldn't agree more. What about you, DK?
It didn't stand out. I mean, it's obviously very much a first time filmmaker. It is a rough around the edges, but yeah, it's all accomplished, and you know, it did well.
Yeah. I mean, there's not really a lot to add to that. Like, a few things that I noticed. I found myself almost having PTSD when it comes to how effective the montage of Dante's daily grind is. So when he's been kind of called into work and doesn't want to be there, and then he has to kind of, unwrap the newspapers and put them in and get all the stuff ready and get the coffee maker ready and do all those things, and then eventually just does it. And then, like in my kind of avatar there, just head on his hands on the desk, like, ugh, this is mind-numbing, soul-destroying work. I've been there. I felt that, and I think a montage was a good way to kind of convey that. although, you know, if I'd been more artistic, I might have dragged it on for 10 hours or whatever to make it really feel like it did at the time. But anyway.
The only unrealistic part about that entire scene for me and the only unrealistic thing in the entire movie for me is that him actually hearing the phone and waking up after closing the night before.
Yeah, but it is.
I would have been me, and someone was calling me before we opened the next morning. I would have slept through the phone ringing.
Yeah, yeah, but then you don't have regular? A film.
So, yeah. Yeah, oh no, I know. I'm just saying that's what to me the most unrealistic thing is. Granted, I'm sure somebody else could. He could be a light sleeper, but me personally, yeah. I think I had something similar one time where a manager got sick the next morning, and I closed the night before, and somebody did that. The only reason why I was able to do it. Is because at the time I was still living with my mother, and my mother answered the phone because it was pre-cell phone. And so yeah. Like it was because it was in like 98. Like it was I had a pager, but and my mom answered, I'm like, hey, it's your boss.
Yeah.
And just like, yeah, and woke up. And so that was the only unrealistic thing for me in that entire opening scene. Other than the grind part of it, 100% was accurate. Oh, yeah. But
I wouldn't say that's unrealistic. I think it feeds into the kind of character that Dante is and that relatable aspect, because it seems so easy to say, just like, ignore it, don't pick up the phone, tell them you're not going in. And I've said that to other people and I've had it said to me, and it really is not as easy as you think. I would be the kind of idiot that would hear it and then be like, oh, what if it's an emergency or it's one of my family or something.
I wouldn't have heard it is my thing. I would have slept.
I mean, like, in that, Venice, he was obviously in the cupboard right next to it.
Yeah. Like I would have, the phone wasn't right next to my bed, like, or anything. Our cordless phone wasn't in that. It was in the living room. Like, I would not have heard. I didn't hear it ringing. The only reason why I did it is because my mother happened to be home and was like, hey, knocked on my door, woke me up, and like, phone, work. Yeah. And so like, I would not have been the person that came in that day because I would not have heard the phone ringing.
Yeah, I do kind of like that aspect as well. It's something that you don't really even think about, but the fact that, like, you're in his room and his bed's right there, but Dante falls backwards out of the cupboard. He was sleeping sat up in the cupboard. He was that exhausted rather than going to bed. And it's so funny, but so like it almost kind of passes you by in the start of that film. Yeah. Or the way that he makes himself like a massive coffee with multiple sugars inside of like what looks like a cookie jar. Huge, you know. Just really good stuff like that, like little things. But like I said, other than that, about the direction, all I can say is, like I said, the direction of what ultimately amounts to like comedy sketches and the way they play out is really good, because there's a visual element to some of them as well, like the Pringles can guy, for example, or like you said, the kind of customers are dumb and they'll ask you a question and then the way the camera pans out to reveal that the answer's right there and stuff like that. I think it's really good. Yeah, and the other one would just be that the one visual joke in the film, which I always forget, which is the way that Jay writes the little speech bubble that says, I eat cock, and then waits for Randall to open the door and holds on that for a very long time, because that is a very good joke, but entirely visual. It's very well done.
Very good joke.
And I mean, other than that, like I said, it's more acting than direction, but I do like the way Silent Bob kind of initially seems very stoic but then breaks into dance. It's kind of a funny thing. Or the way Dante and Randall close up the shop and rebond, and you know, Randall dances out for Dante and then says, oh, you're closed, blah blah blah. It's really nice, isn't it? Like I said, the whole thing is just really well directed, especially for a first feature. So
yeah
can't really add to that. Is there anything else that you guys have on the direction that you wanted to mention, or for that matter, kind of production design, VFX, in so much as there is any, which is not really anything for this movie?
No, you've pretty much said most things.
Yeah. Cool. So, DK, I think you have a bit on the music and sound, which is literally all I had. I'd written like one thing, so do you want to drop that on us?
Let's see if I can get through without sneezing. The soundtrack was released on October 11th, 1994 by Columbia Records under their Chaos imprint. Contains songs by alternative rock, grunge, and punk rock artists such as Bad Religion, Love Among Freaks, Alice in Chains, and Soul Asylum. It's been noted that Clerks is one of the very few films in which the cost of obtaining the rights to the music used was a greater portion of the production cost for the entire film.
Yeah, that's another thing you don't think of, is that licensing music is expensive. And even though I said like it was just under like $30,000 to make the film, yes, a fair portion of that is probably music rights as well. So even less that you actually had in terms of, you know, hiring actors, you know, I would say sets and things, but obviously they were just the shops that, or the stores, sorry, I keep using the word shops, which is very English, the stores that, you know, Smith and his friends worked at, which you can kind of see why. Like I said, I would be curious to know exactly how much of the budget was licensing music, but I don't think we'll ever necessarily find out. But yeah, I mean, again, with regard to music, what can you say other than it's just a very good slice of like everyday 90s, you know, youth culture at the time type music. And yeah, I mean, I know Kevin Smith did direct one of the music videos for one of the main songs, and that's on the DVD and stuff as well. But again, it doesn't really, I mean, it's not fair to say it doesn't stand out, because it doesn't stand out in the regard that it's not bad. It's just good. It sort of fits. It's everything's it's where it belongs. And yeah, any other thoughts on the music and sound?
I still occasionally will randomly break out into Berserker.
I was really hoping somebody would mention Berserker.
It just will randomly pop in my head with the ADHD, and I will 100% be singing that song to myself.
Did he just say, "Would you like to making fuck"?
Yeah. Life is it. Like a ticking clock, Berserker. Would you like it's to really... fuck my cock, Berserker?
It's really good. And then the callback of like, here comes Randall, he's a berserk. Yeah. Very good stuff. And like I said, the fact that when it comes to the sound, there was nobody really assigned to it. It was just, look, whoever's there, grab the boom, get ready, record what we're saying. And yeah, just overall, such a great effort for a very amateur production, I think. And I say that not meaning it negatively. So, yeah. Do you have any thoughts on anything at all then that you wanted to bring up before I go to the, finishing up and off and wrapping up this this thing here?
The more trivia that I think, or not trivia, just something about it that it was at the beginning that wasn't said that I've always found very, very interesting. You mentioned, of course, that like he had used the rest of his money from film school that he had gone to help fund this as well. But the story that I've always found interesting and stuff like that was because, of course, that's where he's met Scott Mosier, and they became not right away, but they became very good friends. And then they both were, he's like, I'm going to leave. I'm going to try to do this. And Scott was also working on a script, and we're like, well, let's, whoever gets their script done first, the other person will help us do that, make it. And Kevin got his done first. And so Scott then became the de facto producer on Kevin's things. I just always found it interesting that, you know, like there's a world, there's a timeline somewhere where Scott got his movie done first. And that Kevin Smith just became a de facto producer. I don't know that he would have ever just become a producer. He probably still would have made his own stuff more, but you know, I just always found it interesting.
No, I think with no offense at all to Scott Mosier, who I'm sure is a great filmmaker and made good movies, I think there's a certain kind of alchemy to Clerks, and it hit at a specific time and captured, like I said, a certain voice that I think it would have been hard to see if anything else would have been able to do the same thing. And I think whenever Clerks came out, it would have probably done the same. You know, it would have hit the same way, provided it was, you know, not 20 years later or whatever, I guess. But I think it's a special movie that that reflects the world around it, shall we say, without wanting to sound too pompous about it. So yeah. And speaking of that, then I'm going to move us to our audience response, which is where we always ask on social media what you think about these movies. And I did get a few responses about Clerks, not a lot, but a few. So I'm just going to jump in and read out the things that we got there. I think they're all from Facebook groups. And the first one here is from Cinema Royale and from Nathan Pinion, who says, I love Clerks to death. It was a really formative movie for me. Infinitely quotable, yes. It was one of the movies that convinced me I didn't have to wait to make films, and I could do it right now with what I had. I cannot overstate the influence Kevin Smith had on my sense of humor as a teenager. Some jokes have aged better than others, agreed, and I haven't really vibed with all of his films in the last few years, but I'm always excited to see what Kevin is going to do next. Yeah, I think I can agree with basically all of that. From Northeast Retro Den, or NERD group, we have a few here. Stephen Robinson simply says, in a row. Gavin Katanak says, one of my favorite films. Ryan Callender says, one of my very favorite films. As someone who's worked customer-facing jobs pretty much continuously since I was 16, I can confidently say that this film does a great job of summing up the drudgery and degradation, as well as humor and downright absurdity of customer service. 100% agree. Also, a great illustration of the Stoic maxim, it's not what happens to you, but how you react that matters. wow, a very deep analysis of it. So yeah, true enough. From our own Silver Screen group on Facebook, Rick Cowlings just says, I'll have to watch it again. I've already said off air, I tend to watch this at least once a year. I love it. I could never get sick of it personally. Melissa A. Nathan says, it's crazy that it's 30 today. I have the 10th anniversary edition on DVD. I didn't see it when it came out, but it got pretty popular in high school a few years later. There were students who made the morning announcements on the loudspeaker, and there were some clerks jokes thrown in. I've often used some of the lines in conversation. I'm not even supposed to be here today is a favorite. I had big plans for a bunch of jokes for my 37th birthday, but my grandmother had just passed away and it didn't feel like arms out to hear that, Melissa. In the Cinema Royale group, Karen Coombs says, people talk a lot about Reality Bites, which is a superb film, but I will always say that Clerks is the film that defines Gen X the best. I said what I said. Yep. Okay. And Sean Dixon, also on NERD, says it's a great film. I'd seen most of the clique films like Dogma and Mallrats way before, but when I got round to this, I loved it. Yeah, and I have one more quite long one. Same group, NERD. Ross Hannon says, controversial opinion, Smith didn't get any better than this. Some inspired mundane chat and thoughts going on. Contractors on the Death Star was next level, but after watching his latest, I came to the realization that he never moved on. His editing is still badly timed and clumsy. Oh, wow. The gold he captured here was the simplicity of two bored dudes talking shit, but at that point, he had 20-odd years of those conversations to mine from. Mallrats and Dogma are fun, but this was and always will be his best and most honest work, but technically awful, and I say that as somebody who loves Kevin Smith. Yeah, I think that's possibly hot take award worthy. I don't know if I agree with the portions of that, shall we say, at the very least, but feels like a sad one to end on, so hopefully we're going to pick things up with our own opinions on the movie, because that was the last thing I have. So, yeah, as this is a Silver Screen regular, I'm going to ask everyone what I always do, which is now going to jump in and ask our favourite character moment and line. And as we always do, I'm going to go to our guest first. So, Michael, who was your favourite character and why in Clerks?
Okay. Well, I said earlier that when talking about character stuff, I love Dante. Randall was my favourite character simply because he was, while he was the exaggeration of Kevin Smith, he was the what I would like to have been like in a retail setting. He's like, because with me working a video store, like it just hammered home, like I was like, I really wish I could say stuff to dumb customers. And so like I just Randall was my favorite simply because of that. Like he was what I was like, what I wish I could be in that regard. So like that, he's my favorite character.
Fair enough. That's cool. Cool, cool. So what about you, DK, favorite character and why?
It's also Randall. Okay. As I say, he starts off being a, you know, pure comedy, and then at the end he's the moral voice, which is weird considering the kind of movies he goes for, but yeah.
Yeah. No, I kind of I understand why you guys would say that. I personally went for Dante just because, like I said, I cannot emphasize enough how incredibly relatable the character was. And it was and is the first time and the strongest time I think I've ever truly felt like I'd seen myself represented in a movie. You know, we can't all be Tom Cruise action heroes or, you know, the badass heroes of our film. But my God, I've been Dante and many a time in life. And yeah, it was interesting to see a character like that who, you know, he's flawed and he's a pushover and he spends the film mourning and letting things happen to him. But I've really just all been so much. I've felt so much of that. And I think that's the strength of, I think, all three Clerks films actually, is how much it echoes your own experience and you feel it at the core, or certainly it is to me anyway. So that's why I went with Dante. So this is going to be a tricky one. Favorite moment or scene in the movie and potentially why, Michael?
I'm going to hit, I think my favorite scene, it's just, there's so many, like there's so many quotable things and stuff like that, like with the 37 and, you know, I just, him reading out those porno movie titles.
Yeah.
In the video store.
Oh yeah, and Happy Scrappy
Hero. And then, like you said earlier, with the humor, like that, the joke of like the kids' movie right at the end, yeah. Like mixed with all those border titles that he's ordering. I don't know. That just has always been one that has stuck with me as one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah, it's a subtle thing as well, but in terms of jokes, it's so weird that he says this really earnestly, but when he's talking about like he went to find specific types of porn at this like better video store, and then when Dante calls him out on it, it's like, it was for you, I was gonna watch it. I wanted us to watch it together, like, really, as if it was the sweetest thing in the world. And I'm just like, this guy is just not quite right in the head, is he, bless him, you know? But yeah, anyway, enough of that. What was your favorite moment and why, Deegan?
It's Whaley's just talked about it. It's the reeling off of the porn titles.
Oh wow, okay. You guys are just in lockstep, it seems like. And once again, I have to be the odd one out. I have to say, I really couldn't quite pick. It could have been any one of the comedy scenes, or like I said, the poignant moments at the end. I could have picked like when Randall delivers the home truths and stuff. But because it was my way into this film, it was what got me started on it. And I still think it's absolutely hilarious. I'm going to go with the Star Wars conversation. Everything from, you know, Empire Strikes Back is the best because life's a series of down endings, which is very poignant to, you know, the guy talking about, I'm a roofer and I didn't take this mob job, so every one of the people on that desktop knew exactly what they were getting themselves into. I think it's brilliant the way it twists pop culture like that. So, and I said it means a lot to me personally because it was the first thing I heard about with regards to this film, and it was what got me to watch it, so I'll pick that. So what was your favorite line and why, Michael?
I think my favorite line is probably still it's the tail end of that, after he's like, don't suck any dicks on the way to the parking lot, and then he's like, and then tells the other guy, he's like, no, you get back here, like that. Yeah, that whole thing there is just a beautiful of comedy gold there. just so many things that happen in that whole sequence with the 37 is just, I mean, like, yeah, you mentioned 37 to people who know anything like that, they will probably get that reference to me. Yeah. So, like, that's why. But yeah.
Yeah, or even in a row. In a row. Somebody just left that as their feedback because it's a great button on that, isn't it? So, yeah, what about you, GK, favorite line?
I'm going to go with the line that sums up not just the film, but working in retail in general, which is, this job would be great if it weren't for the fucking customers.
Yeah, that was exactly what I picked, and I have to say it's because I said that 100 times a day when I was working in retail. No exaggeration. After seeing this movie, I was like, yep, said it so many times.
We were saying it before we saw this movie, so when I saw this movie, like, this guy gets it.
Yep.
I don't work retail anymore, and I still say it.
Yeah, exactly.
There are customers, but I don't work retail. I work in shipping, but I still say it all the time. Like, this job would be great if it was for the customers.
Yeah, I mean, you could apply it to, with slight modification, to anything. Like, you know, the human race would be great if it wasn't for all the fucking people.
Yeah, but I think that is in another movie. I can't remember. that sounds familiar for another movie recently.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, we're gonna just move on then to finish up with our conclusion and our score out of 5 stars, as we always do. And once again, since you're the guest, Michael, I'm going to ask if you wouldn't mind going first.
All right. This movie means a lot to me. It's one of the impetuses for me becoming a filmmaker. I absolutely love it. It's what I hope my first feature film ends up being. Even though I have way more experience than Kevin Smith did when he made this, so hopefully my feature film will be better. Like, it, you know, looking visually and stuff like that. However, I hope to, you know, I hope to get half the reception that this did, but it's going to give 5 stars for me on this. I just absolutely love this film.
That's big. 5 stars. Perfect score from Michael Willey. Right. So DK, do you want to go next with your conclusion and score then?
Yeah, mine's not very long. It's great film, great debut film from Kevin Smith. Ticks all the boxes with regards to the writing, the direction's competent, it's got some decent performances in it. It's a little rough around the edges, but as one would expect from a first timer. And yeah, I'm going to have to knock it down just because of I associate things with it. It's very much a me problem though, but I'm just going to say it's great, but it's not as good as maybe some of his later ones. And through personal views, I'm just going to give it I'm going to give it 4.
Okay, so a 4 from DK. Right. So my conclusion is as long-winded as you would expect, so apologies in advance. I said hilarious, heartfelt, and at times surprisingly heavy. This film captures the voice of a generation and especially the life of the put-upon retail worker incredibly well. There are great running gags, multiple comedy scenes that all knock it out of the park, characters who are painfully relatable and that you instantly care about. The real strength is the dialogue and the budding direction of somebody who would probably balk at the idea, but I would say is absolutely an auteur, a brilliant filmmaker, and a genuine icon. Okay, it is naturally not as polished as some of Smith's later films, given the low budget and the limitations. Likewise, the acting is a little on the rough side at times, and there's a few moments that are not very PC, especially nowadays. But this film gets so much right, nails the reflection of our life and times, makes me laugh, is exceptionally quotable, and still manages to say something and genuinely resonate. As a first movie, I've rarely seen better. And although there would be, in my opinion, better things to come, the spark of it all was right here and almost fully formed from the get-go. Pair it with the sequels for one of the best, funniest, and most emotional triple bills ever, and watch the Viewer Skew films if you haven't. But as the one that began it all, this is way more than a good start. And I went in the middle and gave it 4.5 out of 5 stars. So, yeah, it doesn't take a lot of working out, but, you know, if you wanted to add these together and divide by 3, if you couldn't work it out already, it means that we have a final score for Clerks of 4.5 out of 5. Meaning that I've been proven right and am the most correct and perfect person ever, of course. So there you go. No, I'm very happy with that. I think 4.5, like I said, there's a few rough moments, so it will be hard to say it's perfect. And I do think I would feel bad because there are Kevin Smith films I love a bit more. But my word, it's a brilliant film. And certainly don't let the fact that it's not a 5 mean that you think it's any less than just brilliant and well worth watching if you haven't. And please don't be distracted by the fact it's black and white. I've really had so many young people say to me when I've recommended it, oh, I don't want to watch that, it's in black and white. And it really doesn't matter. I mean, you don't even, or I at least don't even notice after like 10 minutes that it's a black and white movie. It just still, you know, it still plays out and is brilliant. Anyway, so as we mop the floors and lock up for the night, it just remains for me to thank Michael Whaley again for coming for a second week and talking about one of his favorite directors and another great movie. Thanks again, bud.
Thanks for having me. I enjoy doing this, enjoy talking about film, and especially when it involves films that I absolutely love. You need to get we need to have me on here something that I don't actually love, though, so we can get a unbiased opinion on it.
Okay, we'll put in The Room or something for next year, I guess.
Oh no, well, no, see, The Room has a special, like, it's a bad movie, but it's a great bad movie. Especially,
that's the thing. I was trying to think of an actual bad movie and I just could not think of
it. I will say, I know I'm supposed to be in something in February that I haven't seen in a long time, and it wasn't something that was like, oh, I love this, so I'm gonna watch it again. So we will get a real take on the Killer Tomatoes when I do that one.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah, we do have to have you on again. It's always good to hear your input on things. And yeah, I just love hearing people that love film talk about film. Is always good. So yeah, with that all said, whereabouts can people find you on the internet? Do you have any projects that you wanted to plug at the moment?
I'm at Always Michael Whaley on Twitter. I refuse to use X. TikTok, I think I'm still Always Michael Whaley, and I don't post a lot, but I reshare some things. And then Instagram should also be Always Michael Whaley. Oh, sorry, Twitter CM Whaley II. Sorry, I forgot was done prior to me changing what I use for usernames. But Always Michael Whaley on Instagram and TikTok. So.
Great. And you can always find all of these things for ourselves and our guests in the episode descriptions. By the way, if you're struggling, it'll always be there.
I don't know when this one's going to launch. We are still crowdfunding on a feature that I'm working on for one of my buddies who's gone blind, is making a feature film while he can still, you know, has some vision. He's legally blind, though. And trying to get a feature 90s horror slasher made that we're going to be filming over the next couple months. So gotcha. I think the crowdfunding link will be on there.
Yeah, I've definitely already included that in the Scott Pilgrim episode that went out last week, and yeah, you've mentioned it on that, so I will include the link for that in this one as well, just in case
we still got another 40 days for the, or 30 or something days for the crowdfunding.
Oh, you're fine. This goes out November 14th, so I think it'll still be, even if it's the last days of it, it should probably still be crowdfunding. Yeah, so
I think we're still good on
it. I'll definitely include it. Awesome. Yeah, cool. And obviously, thanks as always to my co-host DK for fighting through what sounds like the bubonic plague to be here with me today.
Yeah, I'm going to go get a COVID test now.
Yep. Please do.
Yeah, I please agree. Go and stick your head in a steaming bowl of water or something, because yeah. You don't sound well, bless you. And yeah, you
head
weren't
off,
even
head off COVID with the hydration though. Just get as much on you as you can.
Yeah. No, thanks for showing up, DK. And yeah, again, it was nice to hear your thoughts on the film, and thanks for agreeing to watch it despite the bad memories and what have you. So still a great film though, I think we'd agree on that. So that's gonna finish things for Clerks then, but fear not, we will be back in just 9 days for our 99th episode, believe it or not, as Cinema Classics enters the Age of Aquarius with a hidden gem musical. Then at the end of the month, it's our big 100th episode spectacular as we tackle a huge movie that redefined cinema, fandom, and the wisdom of retaining international merchandising rights. I think we all know what I'm referring to there. That promises to be really special, that one, it does, and a little bit different as well than the way we usually do things, but hopefully it will all come together. So yeah, join us for all of that and more. But for now, remember, you're closed. But...
You've been listening to the Silver Scream Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Scream Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.